In Spider-Man Far From Home, Tom Holland's Peter Parker deals with the aftermath of Avengers Endgame by not dealing with it. He takes a class trip to Europe, attempting to leave his great power and his great responsibility behind.
But, of course, it is not that simple. In his whistle-stop tour of picturesque European cities, he meets up with Jake Gyllenhaal's Mysterio, Samuel L. Jackson's Nick Fury, and a host of elemental monsters wreaking, as you probably guessed, havoc. And, of course, we've got more of lovable classmates like Zendaya and Jacob Batalon. I'm Stephen Thompson.
And I'm Glenn Weldon. We're talking this latest Spider-Man outing and its implications for the future of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, plus what's making us happy on this episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. Also joining us is All Things Considered movie editor Mallory Yu. Hey, Mallory.
Hey there.
It's becoming a habit, and I like it. And finally, we're always happy to have writer and critic Chris Klimek on hand to talk matters superheroic and superhero adjacent. Welcome, Chris.
With great podcasting comes great responsibility, Glenn.
You nailed it. Okay, so we're going to say at the top, it is impossible to talk about the events of Spider-Man Far From Home without at least referencing the events and indeed the ending of Avengers Endgame. So if you find yourself in that vanishingly small cohort of people who care about the MCU but haven't yet seen Endgame, skip this episode and come back later. All right, so Stephen, we'll start with you. First up, what'd you think of the film, and how do you think it stands as a sequel to Spider-Man Homecoming?
Well, Spider-Man Homecoming I greatly enjoyed, in part because it leaned heavily into being a teen movie, and it was as much a teen comedy as a superhero romp. Mm-hmm. This one, for me, it has that kind of standard sequel drift, right, where it takes the characters you know and love and puts them in fancy new settings and places and takes them across Europe and you know, and has them have new adventures outside.
Takes them out of Georgia, which is kind of unique for a Marvel movie.
Exactly. And as such, it's got a little bit of that sequel drift, a little bit of sequel bloat. I did appreciate the many, many elements of this movie that function as meta commentary on the Marvel Cinematic Universe and Spider-Man's place within it. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of talk about who will replace Iron Man? Who is the next Iron Man? And there's stuff about CGI exhaustion that I appreciated as an audience member. There's even a line about no one caring about casualties if there are heroes, mm-hmm. Which I really appreciated. This is a very, very self-aware movie. As a whole, though, I came out of it bubbling less than I did at Homecoming, which I just was such a fizzy and enjoyable movie. This one felt a little bit more the way I feel coming out of a lot of the Marvel Cinematic Universe movies, where it's like, that was pretty fun, and then I have to, like, scramble not to forget every minute of it.
Right, it doesn't stick. Mallory, what do you think?
Same. It didn't leave much of an impression on me. Like, I saw it a week ago now, and thinking about it last night, I was like, I don't remember very much of this. I felt like the stakes never felt quite real, and the superhero aspect or the superhero plot just felt kind of dutiful and like, we have to do this, we have to go big, and we have to have these extravagant CGI fights. And those were fun to watch. It's not like I didn't enjoy the movie. I had fun while I was watching it, but when I left the theater, it was just kind of meh.
Now, Chris, you reviewed the film for NPR, and I got the sense reading your review you were a little bit cooler on it than some of the other sort of nerd press, or at least even mainstream press, about this film.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little cooler than I would be had I been watching this movie in 2020 or 2021.
Right.
You know, I liked it. I think it would have been appropriate
to
take a pause after Endgame. There's also the problem that these actors are all, with the exception of the great Angourie Rice, who plays Betty, one of Peter's classmates, are all in their early 20s already, and they're not going to be able to play teenagers credibly for very long. I think it is a big strength of this current iteration of Spider-Man that Tom Holland is the youngest of the many, many spider actors that we've had in this in this century. The one who seems the most plausibly 16 years old. I think he was 21 when this sequel, when Far From Home was shot. So yeah, I mean, I like it. I like the big superhero bloat battle-y stuff far less than I like the just being a teenager on holiday in Europe stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I liked it. I would have liked it a lot more 2 years from now.
I hear what you're saying about the distinction between the teenage romping, you know, the Agent Cody Banks, if looks could kill vibe of just teenagers in Europe, and the superhero stuff. I'm going to push back a little bit because this is Mysterio involved here, who in the comics, at least, is one of my favorite Spidey characters because he is so goofy. He's just the goofiest character, and his reputation is for being sort of a try-hard and failing all the time. He's got a goldfish bowl on his head. Mm-hmm. He's purple and green. Just from a design perspective, he's just fantastic. And I thought Gyllenhaal was great. I really thought he was having a lot of fun with this. Later on in the film, he gets to play a little bit bigger and broader than he does at the beginning. I think that's a great thing. And for me, the kid stuff had this, and it's not just because of the presence of Zendaya, but it had a kind of a Disney Channel tweeness to it that I wasn't quite jiving with. It felt a little too cute, a little too arch. But I will say that what this film really does is show us where the Marvel Cinematic Universe is going next, and it certainly seems smaller than it did before. I mean, inevitably, the universe was the stakes, and now it's individual cities and even little, you know, landmarks. It's smaller, right?
And that's very much by design. Running through this movie, there are several references, and throughout the history of this Tom Holland Spider-Man character, he's like the B-team, right?
Yeah.
He says, like, I'm your friendly neighborhood Spider-Man. I can't replace Tony Stark. I'm just off here in the B-leagues training to be a better superhero. And the movie feels like it's doing the same thing. And I gotta say, like, I appreciate that the stakes here are smaller. I don't need universe level stakes. It took 22 movies?
No one knows. Kevin Feige doesn't know.
Phase 6? What is this?
Yeah, and like,
Phase 4?
And to be honest, I mean, I really agree with Chris. I could have used a break from this entire world. I could have used a break from references to Tony Stark on the big screen.
Yeah.
This felt way too soon just as a cinematic experience. Like, I like the way Endgame ended. You didn't have a post-credit sequence. You actually got to, like, breathe for a minute with the story in a certain kind of locked in one place, and this immediately having to rev that up again. And by the way, for the love of God, there have been 24 of these movies. Half the crowd walked out of the theater the end, and then just people just leave the theater. Like, it is a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
There are 2 post-credit sequences, one of which is crucial.
Yep. Yeah.
Don't walk out as soon as the movie ends unless you've decided never again to see another Marvel movie.
Steven, it's funny that you mention it's meta, because in my notes I was like, oh, this movie is really meta. It is smaller, and the movie feeling smaller and more personal versus the big bombast of Endgame or the movies that came sort of before it, it's an attempt to signal to audiences that things are going to be a little smaller. The tension and the stakes aren't going to be universe ending. They're maybe going to be world ending or city ending. I feel like Marvel's trying to skirt that expectation post Endgame of, like, the MCU has to be bigger and more bombastic and more trippy and more CGI than the last movie. Does it work? Maybe.
Yeah.
If it's going to be smaller, I need to feel emotionally invested in these characters. And while I did like Tom Holland and Zendaya and Jacob Batalon, I just didn't really feel a connection to the characters. And I think if we had had a little bit of time, a breather, maybe a break, like everyone is saying here, maybe I would have felt more excited to see them again.
Huh. Yeah, the emphasis on their personal lives and their more human-scale problems is what distinguished Marvel in the 60s. I mean, that was what was new about it 50 years ago.
Right.
You know, the DC was doing all the cosmic stories at that time.
Right.
So it's probably instinctive for them to want to get back to that.
I do want to talk a little bit about Tom Holland, his performance, because, you know, this was the thing that I reacted to most strongly in Homecoming. Here, I still love this kid. But, Chris, in your review, you counted the number of Spider-Man-centric films there have been, and that number was 8?
Yes, there have been 8 films with Spider-Man in the title since 2002.
And that's including Into the Spider-Verse again.
So we're not counting the Avengers ones that he's in.
We're not counting the Avengers ones that he's in. But, like, I do think the long shadow of Into the Spider-Verse falls very heavily over this film.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much Into the Spider-Verse did unconsciously, and we've talked about this, that film a lot, but that felt, it was kind of straining a little bit here. Yes, no?
I agree completely. I mean, this is the third movie to feature Spider-Man prominently in, what, 8 months?
Yeah, 6 months. since December, that's right.
That is a lot of Spider-Man.
Yeah, but he's so charming. But, and what I missed was the quipping. Like,
yeah,
Spider-Man is supposed to quip, supposed to say funny things as he's doing things. There's a little cockiness to the character, which Tom Holland, he's not vibrating on that frequency.
Yeah, I was actually a little surprised by that, and I expected Glenn for us to come in here and have this discussion, and you and I would both be sitting here like, needs more jokes.
Yeah.
Because I did feel like this movie needed more jokes. And a lot of times in past Spider-Man iterations, it's a little bit like Deadpool, right? Where like he's wisecracking while swinging on webs or fighting or whatever. Like he's, and the character's covered in a mask. You can loop
as much. You can keep ADRing that long after the film is in theaters.
You can do so much punch up when the character's mouth is covered.
Yep.
And I was surprised that there wasn't a little bit more of that in this one. Once it gets into the heavy plot machinations of buildings getting leveled, there's less kind of, oh my gosh, I'm just a kid, as he's swinging around.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder if it means anything that where the quips have traditionally gone in Spider-Man battles, where he's saying something insulting about the villain's costume or something like that. What Holland keeps giving us is these jokes about age.
Yeah.
You know, saying that, like, he'll always say, oh, you know, I love it, Led Zeppelin when AC/DC is playing, or oh, have you seen that really old movie, The Empire Strikes Back? Mm-hmm. Or, you know, so that's, it's not quite the same level of
verve.
Elan, yes. did I use that word? I thought I did.
Or does it feel like he's focusing on age, or these jokes are more, you know, age-centric because they're trying to emphasize how young he is? Like, they're really saying, hey, you all old guard comic fans, this isn't your Peter Parker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very much not the Peter Parker that I knew from comics.
Right.
I don't know.
In defense of this movie, I will say that a lot of the humor comes from the latter half of the film, which we cannot discuss, and it revolves around things that the Jake Gyllenhaal character is doing, including my favorite line of the film, which is, yes, Janet, I still need the cape.
Yeah. One thing I did appreciate in this movie, especially late, there's a lot of CGI in this film. I did appreciate there are several points where that CGI doesn't look like all the other CGI.
Mm-hmm.
And where they're messing with the look of what you see in movie after movie after movie. I did appreciate the little hints at like new frontiers in visuals. One thing I really appreciated, setting aside its other flaws, about the Doctor Strange movie was that it looked unlike all these other films. Mm-hmm. And I appreciated that there were moments in this where you goggle your eyes a little bit looking at it. It doesn't look familiar to you anymore. And I think that's one thing I really hope we can look forward to in more of these movies.
Yeah. Tell us what you think about Spider-Man. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or tweet at us at PCHH. When we come back, it will be time to talk about what's making us happy this week. So come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. With a franchised network of highly trained agents and advanced marketing tools, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services network members aim to provide something more than just real estate. They think beyond the next transaction and build relationships based on your long-term goals to ensure you'll get all the value that home brings, year after year, home after home. All that more they do, that's home services. Start your home search at BerkshireHathawayHS.com. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With the Capital One Saver Card, you can earn 4% cash back on dining and entertainment. That means 4% on checking out that new French restaurant and 4% on bowling with your friends. You'll also earn 2% cash back at grocery stores and 1% on all other purchases. Now when you go out, you cash in. Capital One. What's in your wallet? Terms apply.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It's time for our favorite segment of this and every week, What's Making Us Happy This Week. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
For the last several days in my household, I have only heard one tune sung over and over again by the great and good Katie Presley, with a shout out to the Claire Stapleton newsletter. I have heard the following jingle. Jessica, hit me one time.
For us, now there is a personal car that has exactly what we're looking for. Taurus! Now there's an American car with the shape and the feel we've never seen before.
For all of us who demand excellence in design and function, for all of us who will not compromise, Ford listened. Ford created Taurus for us.
For us!
That is a 1986 commercial introducing the Ford Taurus. Finally, thank you, Ford, for bringing us a car that looks like a toolbox. The ugliest car you've ever seen. I miss a time when commercials were delivered with absolute unironic fervency. Mm-hmm. Just above all else, I appreciate commitment in my advertisements.
Yeah.
And I appreciate the punctuating of almost every syllable. Now there is an American car that looks... But anyway, you can we'll throw a link to that in our newsletter. Mm-hmm. You can find it on YouTube at First Ford Taurus Car Commercial 1986.
Well, thank you, Stephen. That is an unusual pick, but I buy it. Mallory, what is making you happy this week?
Okay, so what's making me happy is an anime from the 90s, Neon Genesis Evangelion, which just appeared on Netflix.
Uh-huh, yeah, it did.
Basically, what Neon Genesis Evangelion is, it's a show that's set in Japan 15 years after a catastrophic event known as the Second Impact, and it follows a 14-year-old boy named Shinji who has to pilot a giant mecha robot known as Evangelion, and along with other 14-year-olds, in their own Evangelion robots, fight giant mysterious creatures called angels. And I love it. It's easy to see why it's one of the great animes. I'm having so much fun watching it. The animation is gorgeous and effective. The fight scenes are tense. It's also a really fun, goofy show that's like hidden in this very serious show about PTSD and trauma and apocalypse. There are a few things I could do without: be prepared for objectifying shots of women throughout the series, which I could do without. But I love the show, and I've had the theme song stuck in my head for the last 2 weeks since I started watching this.
Okay.
It still bangs.
Mallory, we are simpatico here. The subject of this week's Pop Culture Happy Hour newsletter may or may not overlap with what you just talked about. I love this series so much because I went into it expecting fighting robots and monsters, and I'm getting emo. I am getting so much psychology. I am getting so much reluctant hero sadness and richness. Stephen, you would love it.
I'm just sitting over here salivating. Give us the name of the show again.
Neon Genesis Evangelion.
Yes.
By the time we meet again, we will have a conversation, I'm sure.
Yes. Find it on Netflix and come yell about it with me on Twitter.
Thank you very much, Mallory. Chris Klimek, what is making you happy this week?
What is making me happy this week, Glenn, is history lessons via the $1 bin of your local record store. Jess Reedy.
You are about to relive a very important day in the life of the United States. July 4th, 1970. The place?
Did someone say banger?
Washington, D.C.
You know me. You know how much I love old records. I was surprised to find this one a few months ago. It is a soundtrack album from Honor America Day, which was Independence Day 1970, an event staged mostly by the Nixon administration via their functionaries, J. Willard Marriott and the Reverend Billy Graham. Listening to this old record has been a surreal experience, as has the discovery that you can get it on Apple Music. Mm-hmm. Should you? I'm sure it's been streamed tens and tens of times. The title of the record is "Proudly They Came," ellipsis, to honor America. The lineup of this album and this Independence Day concert, really just all the names that would occur to you if I said Pop Culture 1970. Bob Hope, Jack Benny, Dinah Shore, Glenn Campbell. I wrote a piece about this in the Washington Post this week.
If you wanna
find out more, you can check that out. But that is what is making me happy: the just surreal history lessons via dirty old records.
Excellent. We will link to that in the newsletter. What's making me happy this week is Wizards Unite. Now, it's a Harry Potter phone game built on the framework of Pokemon Go, which was itself built on the framework of another game. It's very, 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 very similar. Only instead of catching magical animals to pit them in gladiatory-like blood sport for your Caligula-like amusement.
Tell us how you really feel about Pokemon, Glenn.
You help Harry Potter and his friends rescue magical artifacts and beloved characters from bad spells, I think. I'm not exactly clear. The story elements of this game are a little fuzzy. It's been successful, not nearly the phenomenon that Pokemon Go was. It's needlessly complicated. It involves inventory management, my least favorite thing about games ever.
I mean, Pokemon Go does too.
Sure. And it is also, just like Pokemon Go, it's repetitive. There are different categories of missions that spring up as you walk around your city. And you do have to play it in the city, just like Pokemon Go. And I don't know if it's just the most common category or if my commute to work is doomed, but my commute is very heavy with Ministry of Magic missions, which is just rescuing the same ministry official and ministry administrator and doing something with the newspaper kiosk over and over again. But then I thought, you know, maybe that's meta, because in the Harry Potter canon, the ministry represents faceless bureaucracy. It's the most mundane aspect of the Harry Potter world. So maybe it's supposed to be boring. maybe that makes sense. But I am having a blast for one reason, and this is a thing that Pokemon Go does not do, which is that the game has licensed the likenesses of actors from the films. So, I mean, if you're in the middle of your commute and you're on the red line and it's stuck and you can get a signal and an imperfectly rendered version of a beloved character actress, Miriam Margolis, turns up on your phone, and you can rescue her from a boobo tuber or whatever the hell, that is a good start to the day. Mm-hmm. I have not yet seen Emma Thompson. I have not yet seen a kind of janky Maggie Smith yet, but I live in hope. It is repetitive, and it is obsessive, but I'm in with both feet. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can find all of us on Twitter. You can find me at G.H. Weldon. You can follow Steven at I Dislike Steven. You can follow Mallory at Mallory_U. And you can follow Chris at C.T. Klimek. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides the music you are bobbing your head to right now, or maybe you're not. I don't know your life. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you, Glenn.
Thank you.
And thank you all for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. And if you have a second and you are so inclined, please subscribe to our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And we will see you all next week.
Hear the stories behind the songs that rally communities large and small across America. Listen and subscribe to All Songs Considered, Throughline, and Alt Latino for a closer look at songs from NPR's American Anthem series.